If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Good morning, everyone. You're on Reality Check Radio. It's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. We've got a favourite guest, New Zealand Initiative. What is it? CEO Oliver? What do you call yourself?
No, Executive Director.
Executive Director Oliver Hartwich, who hails from Germany and is very, very knowledgeable about economics and public policy, and he joins us now. Good morning, Oliver.
Good morning, Rodney. Good to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on, and thank you for supporting us through our downtime and coming on our show now that we're back up and running. It's been wonderful. Now, I'm going to tease you. Have you ever thought of shifting the New Zealand Initiative out of Wellington?
No. I mean, we are a think tank. We have to be where the bureaucrats and politicians are. In fact, when we started the initiative, we had two offices, because you may remember we came out of a merger of two organizations. One of them was headquartered in Auckland, the other one in Wellington. And one of the first questions the board asked me was, where do you think this new organization should be? Well, at the time, I came from Australia. I'd never lived in New Zealand, but I said, well, you want to be a think tank, so you have to be in the capital where the decisions are made, because you need to have these quick encounters and even chance encounters with bureaucrats, politicians, and you simply don't get them if you're not in the capital. And I remember, actually, I worked in London before, which is, of course, a capital, and we had these encounters on a daily basis. And then I worked in Sydney, state capital, but not quite the same. And that's the one thing I thought that was missing from that working in Sydney experience. And so my decision was always, it has to be Wellington, whether you like the place or not.
Do you know that there is a controversy in libertarian circles about this?
There is a controversy. Well, there is an idea, actually, that you should move institutions out of the capital, maybe even ministries and government departments out of the capital, because otherwise you end up in this groupthink. So, yeah, I get that. And let me tell you, there is a lot of groupthink in Wellington. But I can also assure you that the initiative has not fallen into the trap. So we are very much an unusual Wellington organization for still having our own independent thoughts. And actually, I think our office conversations and the conversations around the water cooler and the coffee machine probably sound different than in most other Wellington workplaces.
The great Frank Chodorov, who you're no doubt familiar with, the anarchist, he described famously in a great column that Washington, D.C. wasn't so much a place as a psychosis. And when I read it, I thought it was a very, very funny piece. But over the years, I've come to conclude that there was a great insight, because when you look at Wellington, there is a sort of, want of a better word, mental illness amongst government. And I do wonder, and it's just a thought experiment, what it would be like to have the New Zealand Initiative and say, I don't know, Balclutha. Because I genuinely find my thinking shift, even though I'm not a particularly social person, when I'm living outside of a main centre and certainly away from Wellington and the journalists and the politicians, all abuzz about power and policy and not the cares and worries of tradesmen, families, people outside the system, not living off the taxpayer.
Yep, I totally relate to that. It is definitely different down here. And the only mitigating factor that we have is we travel a lot.
Yes.
And I think that is important to get out. And I have that feeling every time I'm outside of Wellington, and especially South Island. It's a completely different mindset. And Wellington, of course, has bred this kind of biotope of journalists, politicians, bureaucrats, and they all feed off each other, and it's developed a certain mindset. And it is not just something that we imagine. You can see this in election results. I mean, it is no wonder that we have the Greens' strongest performance in Wellington, with two electorates actually won at the last election. It is a different type of thinking here.
Yeah, and we feel a bit frustrated as voters because we voted for change. And I don't know about you, but I'm feeling that we haven't seen much. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, to be fair, they have been in power for not even half a year yet, or just about half a year. We've seen a bit of change, but so far the government has been in repair mode, where the change consisted mainly of reversing previous government policy. I think the next year or two will be interesting to see whether the government's now moving onto its own agenda by actually implementing new policy solutions like charter schools, for example.
Yes.
And
charter
will
schools
be,
I love.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
It's
I mean,
worth
we all
it
do.
For that.
Yes, yes. And I mean, unsurprisingly, they didn't start in the first 100 days because the priority was just to clean up the messes left behind.
Yeah.
But now I think the government is moving on to a different phase, and that will be implementing their own agenda.
Right. We're going to discuss with you, Oliver, now that I've teased you, about shifting to Balclutha. We're going to discuss today with you, first of all, we've had Amy Brooke on, and she discussed her book, which I became enamored of, The 100 Day. Her book is called The 100 Days, and this is a Swiss policy about leaving legislation on the table for 100 days so that people can have a look at it, and if they get upset, they can organize a referendum and defeat the legislation, which I think would be quite dramatic. Second of all, and you have been to Switzerland, you took a delegation to Switzerland to analyze their system. And of course, it's not just one policy, it's a whole different constitutional setup to the Westminster system. And also you've just the author of a publication on, it's hard for me to remember what it's called, the Belt and Silk
Belt and Road, yes.
It's, we're going to discuss what that is, why it's called what it is, and what the concerns are that we should have about it. But start with Switzerland, your trip there with a particular interest on this 100 Days initiative.
Yeah. Shall we start with the trip, or shall we start a little bit earlier? I can give you the prehistory.
Please, please. Okay. We love delving back.
It's a, for me, it's an almost 20-year history dealing with Switzerland. So it starts for me in London in 2005. I had just started my first role in a think tank. That was a small think tank at the time called Policy Exchange. There were only five or six of us in a small office in Westminster, and they hired me as a research fellow for a project on housing affordability. And I was teamed up with a very experienced urban economist, Alan Evans, a professor at the University of Reading in his 60s. And I was a relatively young researcher doing my first job basically out of uni. And the idea was to reform British planning laws, their Town and Country Planning Act, the equivalent of our Resource Management Act, and then release more land for development, make building a bit easier, and everything would be fine. And as a classical liberal economist, a free market economist, of course, I like that idea. However, I thought it wasn't sufficient, and it wasn't quite the right explanation for some of the things we have witnessed in international housing markets, because I came from Germany at the time. I'd spent less than a year in London, and I can tell you, at the time, German house prices were fine. They were not crazy. They were not as crazy as British house prices. And I said to my colleagues, well, maybe there's something else behind it. Maybe it's not just planning legislation that makes the difference. Maybe there are some other factors at play, because in Germany, let me tell you, we have got planning laws too. We have building codes. And if anything, I expect German laws to be even more onerous and harder to follow than your British laws, because we've got federalism as well, and everything in Germany is complicated anyway. So my colleague said, well, okay, but can you prove this? And I said, well, okay, let me have a look at house prices. And I looked at house price developments for more than 30 years. So from 1970 to 2003, I found that British house prices had gone up on average, more than 4% per year above the normal inflation rate. Whoa. So house prices were really beyond good and evil in Britain, a bit like New Zealand, a bit like Australia. Whereas in Germany and in Switzerland, so now we're getting to Switzerland, I found that house prices actually remained stable. So they went up just in line with the normal consumer price index, and that over a very long period of time. And so I said to my colleagues, look, it can't be just planning laws, because both countries have planning laws. There must be something else. And they said, maybe Germany and Switzerland are very different. Maybe you just didn't have the same population or population density or immigration or economic growth or what have you. So I said, okay, well, I look at the demand factors then for the housing market, and I found there was practically nothing between them. Population density about the same. I mean, at least once you account for the mountains in Switzerland. Migration, they also had migration. So really on the demand side, there was practically nothing to distinguish these countries from each other. And yet house prices completely different. And I said to my colleagues, if you want me to find out what's going on in Germany and Switzerland with the housing market, why don't you give me a travel grant? And then I go to Germany, to Switzerland, and I also will go to two countries with a British-style housing story. And these countries I picked were Ireland and Australia. Australia, in my case, because I had previously lived in Australia for a while, doing my PhD. And so I got a travel grant, £5,000, to spend 2 weeks in Australia, a week in Germany, a week in Switzerland, and a week in Ireland, flying economy around the world and staying with friends and family and really doing it on a budget. And that was the beginning of my think tank career, and it was fascinating, and it started my lifelong fascination with Switzerland. So I can now tell you what I found, and it will be fascinating, I think, and then we can go into democracy, if that's okay with you.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Listeners can't see you, but you've got a great grin on your face that this is just something so dear to your heart.
It is. It is the one theme behind all my work, really, in the last 20 years, and something I'm actually really, really passionate about. So that first meeting I had on that research trip was actually in Germany, in my hometown. It's a city of 600,000 people, Essen in the Ruhr. So it's in the west of Germany, and I met with the city's town planner. And that town planner was an old staunch social democrat. And I just did my background research, of course, so I knew roughly how the German planning system worked. And I asked, so can you please explain this to me? And the town planner looked at me and said, yep, okay. Well, you would have read about the federal guidelines from the federal government for housing development. I said, yeah, absolutely. He said, forget about them. That's just to keep the people in Berlin happy. Nobody cares. Mm-hmm. Okay, right. And then he said, and you would have read about regional development plans, state development plans. They are drawn up by the state government and they are legally binding for work here. Yeah. I said, I read about that too. Yeah. Well, there are actually six of them. He said, there's residential development and transport. And then he hesitated. He looked at me and said, I've forgotten what the other four are about. I said, hang on. You just said they're legally binding. And then he looked at me inside and said, come on, I want these people here. They are my taxpayers. And of course, I'm bending all the rules because I want these people to pay their taxes here, not in the Arabing town. And then he basically explained how it worked in practice. And it was eye-opening. And I thought, okay, so it's not the planning laws, as I suspected. It was really who gets the money from development. And then I had more meetings like that in Germany. And after a week, I traveled on to Zurich. And there, it became totally eye-opening because in Switzerland, their tax system is even more direct and even more decentralized. So in Switzerland, they do not have just one income tax. They have three tiers of income tax. So the Federation only receives about 20% of all income tax in Switzerland, and the remaining 80% are shared almost equally between the 26 cantons and the 2,000 councils. Now, to explain this a bit more, Switzerland is geographically the size of Canterbury in New Zealand. But on a population of 9 million currently, they have 26 cantons and 2,000 councils. And each council and each canton sets its own income taxes. I mean, imagine that. They don't have just one income tax system for the whole of Switzerland. They have more than 2,000 separate income tax systems. Now, imagine what that does.
You pay the tax, income tax, in the council or your resident.
And you pay it straight into the council's budget. And then you pay another income tax into the canton's budget. And then you pay final income tax for the federation. So you pay three types of income tax.
And different depending where you live.
Totally different. Absolutely different. Sometimes just moving a few kilometers away changes your income tax bill if you're on a decent income by tens of thousands of francs.
Whoa.
And so what it means is, first of all, the cantons and councils have to compete with one another, a bit like businesses. So they compete quite actively to get people into their areas because they are the taxpayers. And then also they have to compete, of course, in being nice to their taxpayers because otherwise they move away again. They also then compete in the delivery of public services. Or, for example, you need a building consent. Well, if your council is not nice to you and treats you not like a customer, but really is mean, well, they might lose you as a taxpayer. And so they have to be much nicer to their populations than, say, councils in New Zealand.
Wow.
It makes a massive difference. And so I still remember I spent a day with the head of the Canton's planning department in the beautiful canton of Schwyz. So Schwyz sounds a bit like Schweiz. Switzerland often gets confused with Switzerland, but it's just a canton. It's about half an hour drive out of central Zurich. And it was actually difficult getting an appointment with this cantonal planner, because when I first emailed him from London, I said I wanted to meet with him. He said, no, we're not meeting. And then I insisted, no, I really want to find out what you're doing there. And I thought, well, these guys really don't want to meet. And anyway, in the end, I just insisted and he met me. And then he turned out to be the friendliest guy, really helpful and guiding me around the canton, driving around, showing me everything. And at the end of the day, it was a Friday, over a beer, I said, well, why were you so hesitant to even meet with me? And he said, oh, you know, we get a lot of requests from international visitors and they all confuse us with the Federation. We are just a tiny canton. We're just called Schwyz and it sounds so kind of confusing with Switzerland. And that's why we always say no to international visitors, because typically they come and then they're disappointed that we're not the federal government. So anyway, so he guided me around the canton. And again, eye-opening, and I will never forget this experience. So he said, well, we're going to build here and this village is going to grow and we're going to build 200 homes here. And I said, well, okay, where are the NIMBYs? He said, what are NIMBYs? I said, well, not in my backyard. So people who really don't want development, or we don't have that in Switzerland like that. I said, well, what happens to when you go to one of your local villages and you say, I want to build an extra 200 homes here? And he says, well, and they will probably ask me, why not 400? And I said, why? It's beautiful. It's rural, scenic Switzerland where the hills are alive, even though that's Austria, of course. And he says, no, but they are my taxpayers here. And I'm the most popular guy in the canton because I brought in these extra taxpayers. We grew from, I think it was 100,000 people to 130,000 over a relatively short period of time. And because all of these new people came in and paid their taxes in Schwyz and not elsewhere, the canton was able to deliver income tax cuts out of the extra revenue while still financing all the new infrastructure. And then the town planner, cantonal planner, looked at me and says, I'm the most popular guy in the canton because I delivered the income tax cuts. And I thought, okay, now I get it. So that's how it works in Switzerland. So whenever it comes to development, the canton, the council, they receive a lot of the upsides of that development, and that enables them to build the roads, build the pipes, build the swimming pools, upgrade the library, and then with the money that they have left over, they also deliver an income tax cut. And of course, development is popular then, whereas in Britain, but in Australia too, in New Zealand, typically what happens is you have extra development, the council then has to finance it somehow, they will always scramble to get it from the new rates, and therefore they will put up everybody else's rate to make that development pay. And surprise, surprise, development is not popular in New Zealand, and certainly not popular with New Zealand councils. And anyway, 2005, when I learned that lesson in Switzerland, I learned a lot about local democracy, decentralized decision making, direct democracy too. And I took all of these lessons with me. And for the next, 19 years, I've been on this mission now to bring some Swiss learning to, well, first to Britain, then to Australia, where I worked, and now in the last 12 years to New Zealand.
The key for that to work, just listening and off the top of my head, is for there to be a multiplicity of jurisdictions.
Yep.
Because then you get the ease of movement. Mm-hmm. Then each jurisdiction sets a big chunk of the tax that a citizen pays.
Mm-hmm.
So it can't be like just a little bit of rates or whatever. It has to be a big chunk to get the incentives right.
Yep.
And then that means that that jurisdiction has to have control of the apparatus of government in terms of spending. So yep. It would need to be doing education, health, big chunks, big infrastructure, yep. Because otherwise you don't get the incentives aligned.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly how it works in Switzerland.
Amazing. So it's a complete antithesis and reverse to what we do, as you say, in the Westminster systems.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the UK. And the drive for simplicity, indeed, around the world is to align tax rates around the world. The OECD wants us all to align and have similar systems, similar rules, because they don't want one rogue state creating a problem. And so we have tax treaties that tie our tax system to other jurisdictions. Again, this is the opposite of that. And indeed, I'd suggest it's contrary to economic orthodoxy, not necessarily of the free market kind, but of the kind that says you want an efficient system and tax is good, and therefore you want a broad base, simple rules, and the same rules across jurisdictions. So when you're doing business here or there or shifting here to there, it's easy. This is the exact heterodox view of all of those thoughts.
Yes, with one possible exception. You said it's something that happens in the Westminster system in a different way. Well, actually, the Westminster system, the Westminster countries, they were actually a little bit more like Switzerland about 100 or 150 years ago. When you look into New Zealand history, you can see that actually New Zealand started off relatively decentralized.
Mm-hmm.
So central government at the beginning of the 20th century spent about 3-4 times more than local government did. So central government in New Zealand was bigger than local government at the beginning of the 20th century.
Is that per head or in total?
That's in total. That's just when you look at statistics, and Bryce Wilkinson did this actually for us in one of our reports. You can find the graph in a little booklet called hashtag localism NZ, and then look for that graph, where you can see that at the beginning of the 20th century, New Zealand local government spent about 2% of GDP in total. And central government at the time, I think from memory, spent about 7 or 8%, something like that. Now, if you fast forward to today, what you see is actually that central government spends a heck of a lot more. I mean, probably around 30-ish percent of GDP, whereas local government still spends 2%. So actually, if you think about it in relative terms, as a percentage of total government spending, local government in New Zealand was a lot bigger or more important compared to central government 120-something years ago. And actually, if you go back even further into the mid-19th century, central government was hardly there to speak of. And it was local government and local communities organizing their own affairs. So New Zealand actually started off relatively decentralized. And certainly on the Maori side of things, I mean, they were always decentralized. It was organized along tribal lines, of course. There was never a national scheme to speak of. So that is New Zealand. But other countries in the Westminster tradition, I mean, even Britain itself was relatively decentralized. And you can actually see this. I mean, you can really feel it when you stand in front of traditional historic town halls in Britain. You look at the Town Hall of Manchester, for example, and it looks like a carbon copy of the Palace of Westminster. And that tells you something. It does tell you that once upon a time, when these magnificent town halls were built, local government was actually really, really important, because they organized their own local affairs. And National government had far more interesting and important things to do, like dealing with the colonies and organizing the empire. And I always thought that actually as Westminster, I mean, I'm really talking about Westminster now where the parliament comes together, as Westminster no longer had to deal with Australia and India, they probably turned their attention to Anglesey and Ipswich. And therefore, politics became a lot more centralized domestically. And we see this development in British politics, and we can definitely see it also in Australia. We can see it in New Zealand. So local government actually in the Westminster tradition started off relatively important.
So
but central government has squeezed it out.
You think this push to centralization and the elimination of local autonomous decision-making was politicians wanting power?
Yes.
And wanting things to do. It wasn't a, there was nothing else at force. It wasn't some, it was just that politicians keeping busy. Because when I look at local government in New Zealand, it seems to me totally useless.
Yeah, and I can see why you think that.
I was briefly Minister of Local Government, and I was shocked to realize that the councils were more interested in the Minister of Transport and the Minister for the Environment and the Minister of Finance than me, because I had nothing to do with them. But they were utterly controlled by the finance decisions of central government. We'll give you money for this, we'll give you money for that. And by the rules and regulations that central government was lays down for local councils, so much so that they have no effective autonomy. I think we still have district boards for hospitals, God knows why. And we have school boards. And it's sort of like, oh, yeah, you run the school. No, you don't. You're there to give the pretense of running the school. And you think that's happened because the more powerful one will always eat the less powerful one?
Yes, I think what's happened is actually that, basically there is a local problem. People then turn to their federal or the national MP, and they demand a solution from that MP.
Yes.
And so the whole thing gets transferred from the local level to the national level.
Why did that happen in Switzerland?
Well, there's always a temptation to make this happen. But in Switzerland, first of all, they have a very long tradition, going back centuries as a decentralized country. They also have something that's unique to Switzerland, namely that they operate in four different languages. So the majority in Switzerland speaks German. There is a very strong group speaking French. There is a much smaller group speaking Italian. And then there is another group, a fourth language called Rätoromanisch in German. What is it in English? Romansch, I think you would call this. And so you've got four language groups. And they always look at each other with a little bit of suspicion. On top of that, you have different religions. So part of Switzerland is Catholic. Another part is Protestant. And then on top of that, you have all the usual political distinctions between left, right, and center. So imagine the complications you now get. You have, say, Catholic, Italian-speaking left-wingers, and you have French-speaking Protestant or Catholic right-wingers. And you basically have all sorts of permutations now. And so for all of these reasons, you never get the centralization that easily because the whole place is so fragmented along so many different lines that it effectively worked as a barrier against centralization. And that's how Switzerland remained decentralized. So the whole Swiss story is not one of sudden decentralization and discovering that localism works. No, no, the Swiss story is actually one of permanent non-centralization.
And of course, a tough geography.
Yes, there are two, even though Switzerland is a relatively small country, but of course it's a mountainous country. And the other thing I would say is that despite their geography, the Swiss have made it possible that you can basically traverse and cross the country in any kind of direction you like, relying on an extremely efficient public transport system because the trains really run on time to the minute, perhaps to the second. It is like clockwork. I mean, like a traditional Swiss clockwork, this country just works. And it is amazing and remarkable, especially given the terrain, especially given the different languages that they speak and all the other problems that probably arise from that. But they've overcome them and the country is beautiful.
Mm. I have a story to tell, which is like your planning and tax man story. Because a wealthy New Zealander who cashed out of New Zealand many, many, many years ago was always being turned over by our Inland Revenue Department, who were treating him like a criminal and, you know, literally going through his wife's wardrobe and pulling stuff out. And they have the power to do that, far more power than the police. They don't need a warrant. Anyway, he had a guts full of it, and someone had suggested he visit Switzerland. So he went off to Switzerland, like you, and he said he wanted to meet the tax department.
Mm-hmm.
And they clearly figured out he was a wealthy citizen, and they said, sure. Anyway, they met at a very, very upmarket restaurant with this tax man, and he thought this was odd. This bastard's taking advantage of me. And they sat there and talked about food, wine, ideas, and you name it. And he said it was a delightful lunch. And this tax man was suggesting what wine they should drink and what food they should eat and what wine they should have with their dessert. It was a substantial dude. And my friend thought, well, at some stage we've got to start talking, you know, tax rules and all the rest of it. And then he said, towards the end of the day, well, they had the end of the dinner. And he said, what I couldn't believe was that tax man paid for this enormously expensive lunch, and then passed a note to my friend, piece of paper, which he opened. And it had a sum on it. And he said, if you pay this amount each year, that'll be it.
Yeah. Nice, huh?
And then my friend said, but don't you want to know what I earn? He said, I have no interest in what you earn. I have no interest in what you own. I have no interest in what you do.
Yeah. Yeah.
How civilized. He could not believe it compared to the nastiness and what's that word? Envious, you know, when they really want to bring a rich guy down, of our New Zealand and then tax department, and he was gone.
Yeah, and it has a massive implication then for business in Switzerland. So I can tell you a true story too.
That is a true story, is it? Like,
I can tell you one of mine. In 2017, when we took our business delegation to Switzerland, we visited a railway factory. Now, that story is beautiful in itself because the owner of that railway factory, a guy called Peter Spuler, bought it as a railway repair workshop with, I think, 12, 13 people working there in 1989. And he bought it on a bank loan of $6 million. Well, in the meantime, he built it up to a company now employing, I think, 7,000 people worldwide. Whoa. With a presence on 5 continents. And last time I checked, Peter Spuler was somewhere between $2 and $3 billion worth. He also spent 13 years in the Swiss federal parliament, that too. So he's a bit of a larger than life character. And when we visited his factory, one of our delegation members asked, so Mr. Spuler, you've built this massive factory here in this little village in this beautiful part of Switzerland. How difficult was it dealing with the council? And Peter Spuler just laughed. He said, come on, I'm the biggest taxpayer in the council and then the canton. Go figure. They love me here. So, there is a different attitude to that because the council obviously wants business success because they benefit from that. Just as you mentioned your friend, they wanted to have his taxes and therefore they're nice to him. And they want Peter Spuler to be successful with his railway company and that's why they're nice to him.
Because he could
be. By the way, there is a different attitude to wealth and to success in Switzerland. Let me tell you a joke, if I may. There's this joke of a guy turning up at a Swiss bank, and he whispers to the guy at the cashier, and he says, "I've got $10 million I want to put into a Swiss bank account." And the cashier says, "You don't have to whisper. Poverty is nothing to be ashamed of in Switzerland."
Oh, sorry. I shouldn't laugh so much. Oh, that's funny. Oh, my goodness. That reminds me of that story of, which one was the gambler? Was it Murdoch or Maxwell? I think it was Maxwell. Was he the gambler?
I believe and so.
He was Australian, and he is in gambling heavily, and a big Texan starts complaining about Maxwell, and they end up having an argument. And this Texan's an oil man and very wealthy, and is telling Maxwell how rich he is. And so Maxwell says, "Well, actually, how rich are you?" And this guy says, "I've got $100 million or whatever it was, right?" And Maxwell looked at him and said, "Well, I'll toss you for it." Mm-hmm. Which is pretty humiliating, right? Mm-hmm. Now, this is amazing, right? Because you could imagine that one factory that could be supplying 70-80% of the revenue, I'm guessing, to the jurisdiction.
Well, I think it's not the tax rate. I mean, you mean the total tax that they pay?
The total tax huge.
Yeah. Yes, it is massive, and it works. I'll give you another example, another one of my favorite examples. We were with our delegation on a steamboat on Lake Lucerne, and it's absolutely picturesque. So you're surrounded by mountains, and it is just stunningly beautiful. And we had on our board the deputy head of Swiss Tourism with us. And he pointed out on the horizon, there was a mountain with a few cranes on top. And he said, "Look, do you see the cranes here? Yeah. We're building a hotel resort there." Or actually, they are building a hotel resort. Because people then ask, "Well, who is they?" Well, it's the Qatar Sovereign Wealth Fund. And they're building 2 5-star hotels and a 4-star hotel with 400 beds and a project volume of $880 million. Okay, interesting. How did that work? What did your overseas investment office say about the Qatar Sovereign Wealth Fund building there? And in beautiful kind of Swiss English, he said, "We don't have an overseas investment office in Switzerland." Okay. How did it go with the canton and with the council? Weren't they skeptical because it's beautiful panoramic countryside? And they said, "No, Qataris came in and they said, we want to build this hotel resort." And then the council said, "Well, interesting. Well, we're going to take this to our economic consultancy in Zurich and ask them how much tax revenue this will be for us." And then the Zurich economist calculated that for every man, woman, and child in this canton, there would be an extra about $1,000 tax revenue per year forever. And then they thought it was a good idea. Yes. And so the Qataris also asked whether there were any environmental concerns, and they're happy to meet them. And the whole thing took off within 2 or 3 years. And then the Swiss tourism guy looked at our delegation and asked, "Okay, how would that work in New Zealand?" We all just laughed and said, "Well, first of all, the Qataris would encounter the Overseas Investment Office, and that would make their lives hell because they have to then reveal that they are of good character down to the last parking fine they had 20 years ago. And then the whole thing would go to the council and they would encounter our council culture because they've got nothing to gain from these developments and therefore they make life really hard. And then they would encounter the Resource Management Act and that's a complete disaster. And by the end of all of that, having realized just how difficult it is to build anything in New Zealand, the Qataris would take the money and build a hotel resort in Switzerland."
Yes. Oh, my goodness me. It's amazing. Now, what was the impact on the delegation that you took, the delegation of New Zealanders? I'm assuming it's business people, chief executives,
yeah,
wealthy people.
Yes.
What was the impact of them of seeing firsthand the Swiss system?
Well, I can tell you the reason why I took them there, because initially they all thought local government is pathetic. Local government is a pain in the butt. And local government makes our lives hard, and you want to give these guys more power and money. Because I've been telling them the stories about localism, decentralization, my previous trips to Switzerland, but nobody really understood it. They were always skeptical, and they thought, really? And have you ever dealt with a mayor or council? You know what idiots you're dealing with here, and you want to give them more power and money? And it was out of that frustration, having had these conversations for 4 or 5 years, that I said, okay, I want to take you all to Switzerland. And I want to show you how it works in practice. And then you can see it for yourself, and then you can still think I'm mad, but maybe just seeing it will change your mind. And so once we had them in Switzerland, basically we heard these stories and we saw them on a daily basis, and people basically converted to my point of view. And you're right, we had CEOs and chairs of large New Zealand companies with us, including a certain Christopher Luxon. So Luxon was part of our group, and he saw all of that, and he saw it again then when a couple of years later we took him to Denmark and Sweden, and Sweden basically does it very similarly to Switzerland with regional taxes. And so Luxon saw these two models and realized that there is something in it and came back as a convert. And he started talking a lot about localism, the Swiss experience, him being on our trip. And when you listen to Luxon's speeches these days, in every second speech, he talks about localism. He talks about Switzerland. He gives us credit for that, which is nice. And he says that this has changed his thinking on local government. And he basically started talking localism. Localism was a term that didn't exist in New Zealand when we started in 2012. I had dealt with this before, going back to that first job in Think Tank Land in 2005 that we talked about earlier. And I brought this localism idea and concept to New Zealand. And now it has entered our political vocabulary, and the Prime Minister keeps talking about it.
That's amazing. So
that is something that I am personally proud of, because it doesn't happen often that you can actually change the debates in such a way and actually introduce a completely new concept to a country as a think tanker. And so if I had maybe one or two achievements from my time here at the initiative the last 12 years, that is one of them.
For sure. Of course, not everyone can go to Switzerland and see it and experience it, because it sounds so pie in the sky and so counter our experience. I understand it now, because the point is, the local councils are much smaller than probably our councils, but they're also empowered. And that's the bit that we don't see now. So if you're talking to a business person, they don't want to go and see the local mayor or the council, because they can't make anything happen. They want to go to people that can decide something, and that's either the planner bureaucrat process, which they can't abide because it's counter to being an entrepreneur, or the Minister of Finance, say, who can snap their fingers and make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, what you've got in Switzerland is you can meet the local guy or girl who can make it happen, but more particularly, they're incentivized to make it happen. Not open slather, because they'd get voted out of office if the Qataris built a big mosque or something, right? They have to be within the Swiss district. So it's not what people might imagine open slather, but he or she is incentivized to build that tax base.
Exactly. And it doesn't work the same way here. So I want to give you a couple of counterexamples from New Zealand to show you what happens when you've got a system that is utterly centralized, the opposite of Switzerland. So you probably remember that last year we heard a lot about the new Sleepyhead factory.
Mm-hmm.
So Sleepyhead wanted to build a new bedding factory in the Waikato. And they didn't just want to build the factory. They also wanted to build a whole new suburb around it for their workers. The response from the Waikato was, well, really? Does it have to be here? Can't you do this elsewhere? because they only saw the problems with transport and infrastructure investment and dealing with the neighbors, the NIMBYs, and they didn't want to have the factory. And so they actually tried quite a long time, actually, they tried to push Sleepyhead away from the Waikato. Now, you understand this actually within our current system of local government finance. But actually, if you think about it, in which other country would that happen where you've got a massive new factory development proposed for an area that probably needs a bit more economic activity? And the locals say, well, actually, but not here. Or another example, which I can't name, unfortunately, because we talked to the CEO of a small company, but on the condition of anonymity, because he just wanted to pass on his stories to us. But actually, because he's dealing with a council on a daily basis, he can't afford his name to be anywhere in public. Well, let me just summarize the case. It was a small factory. They wanted to build a small factory since 2018. They had complete support, actually, from the local iwi. It was actually on iwi land. And the council made his life a hell because from the resource consenting applications, the council constantly asked for more information. They dragged their feet, actually. They just asked for more clarification. Every bit of clarification asked typically meant an extra $5,000 to $20,000 for some consultants. And so the factory still, after 6 years of planning this, is still not up and running, even though it's a relatively small factory in a part of New Zealand that would definitely do with a bit more economic activity and a bit more employment. Mm. Now, the reason why it never happened is because there are no incentives for the councils to be nicer to this guy or to this factory, because in the end, they don't really benefit from it. The taxes,
that you see costs and problems.
Yeah, the GST, the corporate taxes, even the income taxes of their employees, they will go to Wellington and the council is left with a cost. And the only bit of incentivization that's happening in New Zealand, that CEO told me, is when you can kind of find some soft bribes. So, yeah, but for some of the works that he will do around the factory, you know, the son of a councillor's cousin or whatever, maybe you can actually ask him for that. And that would probably get you in a favorable light with the council processes. So that's this kind of soft level of corruption that's sometimes happening in New Zealand, whereas in Switzerland, well, I wouldn't say the corruption is institutionalized, but the incentives are built into the system. If the council gets the taxes out of that, there is a very good reason to make sure when the application is made, the factory starts next year and not 6 years later, because you want to get the taxes. And so I think that is the major difference, really, between development in Switzerland and development in New Zealand.
None of this would be a surprise to a public choice theorist.
No, of course not. And none of this would be a surprise to anyone in the classical liberal tradition. So when you read Hayek, for example, he writes about decentralization and localism. In passing, I mean, that's not the core of Hayek's thought, but I mean, that was how he saw local government. Local government should be in charge of all the things that can't be dealt with at a higher tier of government. And then if they're incentivized properly, they will do it and will do a good job. And actually, it's not a surprise to anyone, even on the conservative side of politics. I mean, this is basically the small platoons. Or this Edmund is actually, Burke. Yeah, it is Burke. Or that is Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America. De Tocqueville.
Because America is very decentralized.
Yes. What I'm saying is, in the conservative tradition of Edmund Burke, in the Tocquevillian tradition of analyzing how the American democracy worked, I mean, all of this is very much full of localism and decentralization. It is just something that we, I mean, especially in Westminster tradition countries, have lost over the last 100, 150 years. This is not an alien concept, or shouldn't be an alien concept, even to English-speaking countries, to Westminster-style democracies. It is not a Germanic solution or Swiss solution. This is actually how we used to be. And we lost this, and we were taken over because of political reasons and public choice reasons by an ever-growing centralist monster of a state. Yeah. And I think we have to turn this back, and we have to become more Swiss. And if we become more Swiss, I think we'll become a lot more successful. In that way, we can probably solve our housing market, because once councils actually want to build more because they want to compete with one another for residents, you will increase housing supply. You can probably also find better transport solutions. You will probably also keep taxes lower because you'll have neighboring jurisdictions competing for people. So they have to compete on the services they deliver, but they also have to compete, of course, on tax rates. So you will always have a competitive check on the taxes that you charge. And we will probably also get more economic development of the kind that I mentioned with the hotel development or the railway factory. So, I mean, it's not a panacea, but it's close.
Even corruption is eliminated when you localize because people know and can do something about it. So the example would be, I'm guessing, Sleepyhead would say, oh, we're looking for somewhere to build a new factory and accommodation. Well, every hand in New Zealand council would shoot up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be competing for this opportunity.
Yes. And it would also actually show up in places with tourism. Think of Queenstown.
Yes.
So Queenstown has, 10,000 ratepayers and millions of tourists per year? And the ratepayers complain, we have to actually deliver all of this infrastructure. And
we hate all the buses.
And the tourists don't actually pay tax in Queenstown. Mm. All the tourist taxes go to Wellington. So whenever there is GST paid or corporate taxes are raised from the tourism operators, they go to Wellington. Mm. Now, in a Swiss case, of course, the taxes from that tourist activity would stay local. This would be a wonderful thing for Queenstown. And the Queenstown residents would benefit. They would probably pay extremely low taxes because tourism generates so much.
No, well, the example I was thinking of, I'm just thinking this out loud. If you're the mayor of Pedunk Council, and you say to Sleepyhead, look, give me a bit, and I'll pocket it, and we'll forget about putting it in the revenue. It'll be your best deal. He's going to be caught first day because the residents are going to be reading the council accounts and say, well, where's the tax coming from this? We don't read central government accounts because individually it's nothing to do with us almost. We're such a small part of it. But if Sleepyhead coming to town was going to financially and materially benefit you, you'd be all over it with the council.
Yeah. There's another way of looking at it. We currently say to Auckland, for example, well, you have to absorb, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of new people over the next 10, 15 years. And ordinary Aucklanders will say, hang on, we are already dealing with traffic congestion. We have massive problem with access to public services because the city is full. House prices are out of control. And you guys want us to absorb an extra few hundred thousand people over the next few years. You must be crazy. And especially because whenever this development happens and the council now wants to finance the infrastructure to make it happen, you're putting up council rates. And they've gone up massively in the last few years. And so economic development or residential development is not a good news story for Auckland, or at least for Aucklanders. Now, imagine you turn this around, you turn Auckland into some kind of Switzerland, where, a development happens, you've got new people coming in, you have new business development, but it also means that Auckland will get more tax revenue. So you can actually finance the upgrades to the transport network that they need. You can finance the upgrades to any other public service because you want to accommodate these new people when they come in. And then you might even have some cash left, and instead of increasing the rates, you might lower them and say, we can actually afford now to lower your rates because we had so much new development. And suddenly, this whole development story becomes a good news story, not something that the locals would fight, where the NIMBYs could say, well, just push this out and let it happen elsewhere. We don't want these newcomers here. So you completely change the narrative around where economic development and growth is a good thing again. Wouldn't that be nice?
It'd be lovely. We saw the difficulty with charter schools. And I always felt the problem there was, and you probably agree with me, that we only did a few. If you did a lot, it would be impossible to reverse because no one would give up their school. But you can bowl a few schools and upset a few hundred people. You can't upset tens of thousands of people. We know the government departments and the machinery of Wellington are going to hate this. because they're going to have to shift to Balclutha. No.
Well, that gets us back to the beginning of the conversation. I mean, you don't have to shift central government out of Wellington, but you shift individual decision-making processes and policy areas out of Wellington to the regions.
So let's imagine this. This is dreaming, right? And to think about how this could be done. Christopher Luxon says we're going to do localism. We're going to make it work in a Kiwi way. I know just the man to be put in charge of it, and his name's Oliver Hartwich, right? And he rings you up and says, you're going to take over the apparatus of government and you're going to gut the decision-making power of Wellington and you're going to shift it to what we have now in these existing councils. And you're also going to gut the power of Wellington so that these councils are autonomous. Right? Could it be done if there was a political will to drive that through?
Sure. I mean, what you couldn't do is you couldn't turn New Zealand into Switzerland.
No.
Because
you can't make hundreds of years of history.
Exactly. And we don't have the four different languages and all the other historical, I was going to say baggage, but actually it's a positive thing in Switzerland's case. Mm. We don't have that. We can't actually turn New Zealand into Switzerland. That would be folly. That said, you can learn, and you can learn the lesson of Switzerland. The lesson of Switzerland, the main lesson, I think, is you get more of things that you incentivize. Well, that's basically public choice economics. Mm. That's economics. Of course, you always get more of things that you incentivize. So how about we incentivize economic development and residential development? And how to do that? Well, say, as a very rough measure, you measure how much revenue is generated from a new residential construction project. And then once you have calculated the GST revenue from that, you earmark the revenue and say to councils, and that's yours. Now imagine if you said to all councils around New Zealand, maybe just as a pilot project, for every house that you get built in the next 5 years, you keep the GST. I predict this would trigger a massive housing construction boom. Because councils would think, well, this is our once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to really increase our tax take and actually get all the money in that we always wanted for all the other things we want to do. They would consent with their ears pinned back. And would get a massive construction.
Do you think it would be enough? Let's think about it, just off the top of my head. You've got a subdivision with 400 houses.
Mm-hmm.
Say a million a house.
Yeah, okay.
400 million.
Mm-hmm.
GST would be 15%.
Mm-hmm.
10% would be 40 million. So 15% would be 60 million.
Mm-hmm.
You think that would swing them?
Yeah, because currently they get zero.
Oh, yes. But I'm thinking of, I mean, I'm fully on board with you for Switzerland. I worry that this thing doesn't work on a wee switch, right? You have to get the incentives absolutely aligned.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder if a council would be swayed by 60 million to do a development.
Oh, I can imagine many councillors and mayors, when you told them, hey, there's $60 million for you, I could probably see the dollar signs in their eyes.
Yeah, and just for listeners, this isn't in their pocket. This is for their budget for work they're doing. And ACT had that as their policy, right?
Yes, ACT actually took this from us. We first proposed this in 2013, believe it or not.
Yes.
And it took about 10 years until ACT put it into their manifesto. And just a few months ago, National adopted it too. So Chris Bishop is now talking about GST sharing with councils. But it's exactly that idea, to incentivize them so that they do the right thing.
Mm. So not only have you got Mr. Luxon talking localism. You've also got an initial policy initiative underway to that effect.
Yes.
Well, that's an extraordinary achievement.
We're happy. I mean, it's a first step. There should be many more to follow. But if we make this work, I think we will change the way the country ticks.
Well, when you look at housing, it's having a savage social cost because basically you've taken out the middle class in New Zealand and the aspiration of a working person being able to get married on an average wage and own their own house over their lifetime is not a possibility. That's changed the attitude to marriage. It's changed the attitude to having kids. It's changed the attitude to your democracy because you're having a have and have nots. You've changed aspirations. All of that flows from what we used to call a property owning democracy or the quarter acre, half gallon. What was it? Pavlova paradise. It was,
yes.
You're a young person now. You're never going to own a house in New Zealand on our present trajectory.
Exactly, because
and his mum and dad own one that they can give you.
In some of our cities, we have so-called median multiples of more than 10, meaning that you need 10 times the normal household's income. And actually, this is sometimes, of course, or most of the times these days, two people working, whereas previously it was just a sole breadwinner.
Yes.
So you now need two incomes for 10 years to pay the median house, so an average house. Whereas historically speaking, it was three times the household income, which was often just a single income. And so we can actually see just how affordable homes used to be. So they have gone from three times household income where it was a single earner to 10 times household income where two people are working. And that means we have completely lost our housing affordability in our biggest cities. Auckland is probably the worst. Queenstown is, of course, a complete disaster. But actually, even Wellington is not much better. And the only place that seems to be a little bit more affordable because they built more is Christchurch for of the big cities. You can change this with a different structure of local government finance. And I think you can also make these cities more economically prosperous because it is not just residential development, of course. It will be business development too, because the same logic applies there as well. So once councils are more in favor of opening the next sleepyhead factory or maybe opening the next IKEA or supermarket, I think we will completely change the way the country works. And then we become a much more successful country. I think we could also take this as a rescue plan for our democracy, because it would mean that a lot more decision-making is happening at the local level. It would also mean that councils actually become more important again, whereas currently they have little say, as you mentioned earlier. And then you will also struggle to get decent people into a local government, because once, if you know that you really have limited budgets and you don't really have much discretion, I mean, why would you spend all your evenings with council affairs as a councillor? Why would you actually give up your time for that? Whereas if you are dealing with councils where you can actually have some policy-making discretion, where you have decent budget, you would probably attract different people into local government. Again, that's happening in Switzerland. In Switzerland, they have kind of professional people, qualified people who are willing to stand for council or for the canton because they know they can make a difference. And by the way, same happening at the federal level too. That's why Peter Spuhler, the guy from the railway factory I mentioned earlier, was a member of parliament for 13 years as well. So you get these people into democracy. The other thing actually that happens, and we haven't even talked about this yet, direct democracy. So the referendum process, where things can be challenged and where the people actually have the final say on stuff. Well, that also then means that people will have to have more debates about political affairs. And it then becomes a rescue plan for not just democracy, but for the media. So in Switzerland, the one thing that really surprised me when we visited was they had more than 400 newspapers, daily and weekly newspapers across the country. So a country of 9 million people has 400 newspapers. And the reason behind that is because they need to have these fora for debates, because a lot of decision-making happens at a local level. A lot of it is challenged in a referendum, and they need a platform to discuss all of this. And that's the media. So Switzerland works so much better on every single front with a very strange political system in some ways. I mean, for a start, they always have the same parties in coalition, and they've had them for decades now in a permanent all-party coalition at the national level. And yet it works. By the way, the other thing is, do you know how many ministers they have in Switzerland?
I do, because Amy Brooke told me.
Yeah.
5 or 6 or something ridiculous.
I think it's actually 7 from my something memory. Anyway,
like that, yeah. And the Prime Minister, no one's ever heard of, and correct. He rotates.
Yes.
And because it's gutted of power.
Yes. It rotates, and it doesn't really matter. When we visited Switzerland, we had a Swiss think tank colleague visit us and talk to us about the Swiss political system. And he said, actually, on the train ride to your conference hotel, I looked up who the current president is because it doesn't matter. And then he explained the story about the constant and permanent all-party coalition in Bern in their capital. And one of them said, well, hang on, how does this work? So you don't have an opposition. And then our think tank colleague from Switzerland said, but the opposition is the people. This is great.
And so, of course, the media, the people,
and you can put everything to referendum. So you've got 100 days after a law is passed, and then you can collect 50,000 signatures. And if you find the 50,000 signatures, the whole thing goes to a binding referendum. And so what it does is actually it makes lawmaking better, because you would not usually pass things that are just technically stupid and don't work, because they will always be taken to a referendum and then thrown out. So you actually try to find a lot of consensus in the lawmaking process. You try to make sure that the laws are actually good laws, because you want to minimize the chances that the people will just throw them out after the 100-day process.
What a lot to learn. What a lot to take on.
Indeed.
Well, Oliver, we never really got on to the 100 days because I felt there would be a historical and constitutional environment within which that sat. And it's also a fascinating philosophy, because our philosophy for when there's a housing crisis is to demand central government do something, and for central government to take on greater responsibilities for housing in New Zealand. And it's the reverse of what is needed. It's so counterintuitive. I'm not going to get into the debate here because it always sparks off, but I'm going to mention this. I had hoped that with the Auckland Council, making it one council, that I would establish something like the old provincial system, and that the mayor and the council would become sufficiently powerful to advocate for Auckland and rival in terms of the debate and the discussion Wellington. Never happened. It just became a big council, which is to my shame and chagrin. And it needs, I guess, not just the, it needs that cultural shift of understanding of what you've got and what you're trying to do. And I didn't succeed. So I'm forever annoyed with myself over that. But that's for another day. Oliver, we took up the whole time on Switzerland, but what a delight. What a tour de force that was of a different constitutional arrangement and the completely different outcome that you get with a slight tweak, and that you can't get it by, what's that thing? This would be my mistake, tweaking the Resource Management Act. It actually needs a shift in the incentives on councils and their relationships with their residents.
Yeah, see, Rodney, actually on that, the one thing that I learned over the years is, as much as I would like to change the Resource Management Act and as much as I would have liked to change the Town and Country Planning Act in Britain, I think actually the incentives matter a lot more. You can have a substandard law and make it work better with the incentives, because that's exactly what I learned in Germany. Remember when I told you about the town planner in Essen who said, well, we've got all of this stuff and it's legally binding. And I have forgotten what it says because the incentives are so strong. And that's when the penny dropped for me. And I thought, well, actually, forget about reforming the Town and Country Planning Act or here the Resource Management Act, because it is totally difficult and complicated to change this monster of a law. But if you inject the right incentives, basically you torpedo the underlying system.
Have you read the books by Robert Caro? C-A-R-O?
No, I haven't.
Well, you found out at a very young age what I only discovered at an old age, again, to my great annoyance, but I guess it's proved you're still learning. But I worked this out in Parliament also, and Robert Caro has written an amazing book on a man called Robert Moses that no one listening will have ever heard of. And he's also written 4 or 5 volumes, I forget, a magnificent, the greatest book I've probably read. I've read it twice. It's just so wonderful, on a guy who I had no interest in. But this book is so well done. It is unputdownable. And it's huge. It's Encyclopedia Britannica, on Lyndon Baines Johnson. And what fascinated Robert Caro is how power is exercised. And the particular example is with Robert Moses, who was a bureaucrat in New York, who built New York. The entire motorway system, where buildings are, where parks are, was all the work of an unelected official. And he was, as you say, he didn't care what the rules said. He knew where the levers were hidden, and he could pull them and push them and make stuff happen. And Lyndon Baines Johnson was a very gifted politician in many ways, in the worst sense of the word. He turned up to the Senate, for example, and nothing could happen in the Senate. Couldn't get anything through the Senate. And you had to be there for 20 years before you'd even become a chair of a committee. Within 3 years of him being there, nothing happened in the Senate without his say-so, because he could figure it out. And it's this wonderful thing about, you and I started out our lives from university looking at what the rules and the procedures and the processes were, thinking that they followed like clockwork. And then you meet this person and they just make it happen. And you and I have seen it with entrepreneurs, and we've seen it with entrepreneurial politicians and bureaucrats who can make stuff happen.
Yep.
And that's a key too in it all, which is a long way of saying is, you can write all the rules you like. You can have absolutely perfect rules and they're badly used and abused. You can have wonderful rules. It's actually ultimately the incentives that operate on civil servants and politicians just as powerfully as they operate on citizens deciding to shift town, get a new job, study at university, get married. It's the same thing that is affecting them, which is, of course, public choice theory. It's just the application of economics to public life. Oliver, we're going to have you back, I'm pleased to say, if you will will come on, because we never covered, and I'm fascinated by it because I know nothing about it. Every time I mention it, I've got to go to your webpage to remember what to call it, and it's called the Belt and Road Initiative. God knows how you get such a clunky name as that, but I've got to switch out to go Belt and Road. It was a Silk and something road. It was a new Silk Road. It's been different things.
Yep.
You've published on it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to have you back, please, for our listeners, to explain what the hell that is.
Okay, I'm happy to come back anytime.
And thank you for today. Oh, my goodness. We really have been lucky. That was Oliver Hartwich. He's surrounded himself in the Wellington psychosis, but able to lift his head above it and look at it and actually be a counterinsurgent, I guess. Because he's saying, no, no, push the power away from Wellington, push it down to the people, push it down to the locals. Is he talking pie in the sky? Well, he's got the Prime Minister talking about it over years of work. And he's got Chris Bishop doing it, Minister of Transport. It's a remarkable achievement. We're very lucky. Send us a text, 2057. I should say, much more achievement than me in my political life. And send us a email at inbox@realitycheck.radio. Thank you so much for listening.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.